Iran in the early morning hours of Saturday, October 26. According to most Western media outlets, Iran's Air Force carried out a quote, precise airstrikes targeting strategic military sites, including ballistic missile manufacturing sites and air defense batteries. However, we are hearing from non-Western media sources that the Israeli strike on Saturday was much less impactful than outlined by Israel and the West. Nevertheless, it seems that regardless of the extent of the U.S.-Israeli strikes against Iran, that they bring us one step closer to an all-out regional war, and thus one step closer to World War III. But Dr. Horn, what is your ongoing analysis about the increasing aggression by the U.S. and Israel against Iran?
Well, we have a lot to discuss this evening, but an overarching theme is that this current moment represents most likely a global shift of Copernican import. That is to say, that with the BRICS summit, the entente between China and India, there is a distinct possibility that we are witnessing a very rare moment when there is a changing of the guard internationally. This opens up immense opportunities for our movement, but of course, immense opportunity does not necessarily mean that we'll take advantage of same, because our antagonists, as they are pressed to the mat, may find the strength to extract more from our hides as a result of their own decline. So I say that as a prefatory message to this Israeli attack on Iran. As you suggested, there's a split. The Wall Street Journal and the New York Times suggests that it was a marvelous victory for the Iranians, for the Israelis. But Mohammad Mirandi of the University of Tehran, Alistair Crooks, the former British diplomat from the region, Scott Ritter, the former United Nations arms inspector, argue the exact opposite, that it was a dud. And as we sift through the tea leaves and try to figure out what's going on, it's remarkable to note that as we speak, the Israeli cabinet does not have a secure place to meet, because with the attack on Mr. Netanyahu's residence, they feel that if they meet at their usual sites, they'll be targeted by Hezbollah drones. At the same time, the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, in a remarkable interference in the internal affairs of a sovereign state, has basically counseled that all of the forces in Lebanon should gang up on Hezbollah, which in a sense means ganging up in a kind of ethnic cleansing of the Shia population of Lebanon, and a return to the bad old days of civil war of recent decades. With regard to the attack on Iran as well, I think it's going to put enormous pressure on U.S. ally, that is Jordan, because apparently its airspace was used. And we also know that the so-called king of Jordan is not the most popular figure in that particular country that has a substantial Palestinian population. And one of the reasons he's been able to survive is because of munificent subsidies from the US CIA, meaning our tax dollars. We should also pay attention to the role of the Saudis, who of course refused the invitation to BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and South Africa, but at the same time, apparently have been engaging in maneuvers, military maneuvers, alongside the Iranians. That's really significant news. And speaking of significant news, it's also been reported, as we suggested last week, that Azerbaijan, which has a big brother in Turkey or Turkey, might also be implicated in the attack on Iran, in the sense that it's territory was used for that attack. And once again, it shows this double game that the Turks and the Azeris are playing. And this brings me back to my original point, which is, as the previous point suggests, even if one accepts the questionable idea put forward by the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, that this was a successful attack on the Iranians, these other signals and signs show that imperialism is on the defensive in that part of the world. And we should also pay attention to the fact of the split in the international community with regard to these U.S. elections that are upcoming, because we know that, for example, the scuttlebutt from the region is that Mr. Netanyahu would prefer to see a Trump victory. Certainly his major subsidizer, speaking of the billionaire Miriam Adelson, an investor in Las Vegas casinos, also would like to see a Trump victory. She supports both Trump and Mr. Netanyahu. And of course, the not so hidden agenda is that if their wishes come true, then Israel will probably try to come to some sort of settlement with Hezbollah, because obviously they can't win that battle, so they can gear up for an all-out attack on the Islamic Republic of Iran. Russia, as you know, is not necessarily opposed, to put it mildly, to a Trump victory, because Mr. Trump would like to cut a deal with Russia so the Republicans could focus like a laser beam on China. Mr. Trump also has been negotiating during his first term, his first administration, with the North Koreans, and they probably would not necessarily be opposed to his return to the White House as well. But at the same time, if you look at other sources and forces, for example, you'll see that the Iranians most likely would not like to see Mr. Trump return to the White House. They feel that if Vice President Harris assumes the mantle of power, that she'll return to the policy of Mr. Obama with regard to painstaking negotiations concerning the nuclear accords and all the rest. Obviously, the EU is hotly opposed to Mr. Trump returning to the White House, and most likely would see a victory if Vice President Harris prevails. And with regard to China, it's probably, I'm not sure if they see a upside to either person returning to the White House, because with this bipartisan consensus that China is the enemy du jour, that suggests that there will be a new Cold War targeting China, irrespective of who enters the White House. Of course, Mr. Trump has pledged to raise tariffs sharply, not only against China, but against the EU and virtually every other trading partner. What's interesting about Mr. Trump's campaign is that apparently he has this idea that U.S. tariffs, taxes on imports from China, European Union, et cetera, can be raised to a level whereby you can cut taxes against his 1% supporters. And of course, he's holding out the promise to his middle class and working class supporters as well. But if you accept that particular nostrum, you probably should invest in buying the book Brooklyn Bridge. So in any case, at the end of the day, as we do this circuit around the planet, these upcoming elections have, I think it's fair to say, split the international community, has divided the international community in a way that has divided the electorate of the United States of America.
Thank you for that answer, Dr. Horn. And sort of sticking with the election, we also wanted to ask you about Donald Trump's Madison Square Garden rally held this past Sunday night, which included one profoundly disconcerting insult after another, including from the so-called comedian Tony Hinchcliffe, calling Puerto Rico a, quote, floating island of garbage, end quote. And of course, the other wing of the ruling elite was in Arizona this past Friday, wherein President Biden issued a, quote, formal apology for the violence and terror inflicted by the U.S.-run so-called Indian schools or the indigenous boarding schools, while simultaneously providing bombs, weapons, support, and cover to Israel's expanding genocidal campaign in West Asia, not least Palestine. It is reminiscent of a theme in your Texas book, wherein you state that one wing of the ruling elite wanted to liquidate the indigenous and the other wing wanted to place them on reservations. But Dr. Horn, as this settler colonial history continues to haunt us, and with less than 1 week away from the election, What are your thoughts about Trump's rally in Madison Square Garden in New York City and the Dems' utter hypocrisy of empty apologies for past genocides while fueling and supporting a real-time genocide?
Just a few notes that have generally been neglected. October 28th, 1974 was a remarkable day at Madison Square Garden. It was a jam-packed rally in favor of Puerto Rican independence. Interestingly enough, on the 50th anniversary of that remarkable day, you see this outrageous comment about the Puerto Rico. Interestingly enough, at that 1974 rally, one of the speakers was Ella Baker, a foremother of the anti-Jim Crow movement, who has been the subject of a number of documentary films, books as well. I also recall from my own history that the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is still in existence in Lower Manhattan, and I used to work for one of their projects, that they were very active on the Puerto Rico front. Someone needs to write about it. They had a lawyer on the island, Abby Lugo, who was quite active in federal courts on behalf of the independence movements. And it also reminds me of the leader, or a leader of the independence movement, Juan Marie Bras of the Puerto Rican Socialist Party. And one of the questions that crossed my mind was, in the aftermath of this insult directed at the Puerto Rican people, whether or not it would have a catalyzing impact on the struggle for independence, because we all know that Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, and that since it was seized by U.S. imperialism at the end of the 19th century from Spanish colonialism, intermittently there has been an ascending independence movement. And I'm curious to hear, perhaps even from someone in our audience, whether or not this current controversy will have a positive impact on the independence movement. And of course, the next question is the impact on the U.S. election, given the fact that there are 5.8 million Puerto Ricans in the United States of America, with significant population in both Pennsylvania, a swing state, Florida, not a swing state. And given the fact that Puerto Rican celebrities from Jennifer Lopez to Ricky Martin to Bad Bunny et al. Have denounced Mr. Trump and his campaign. Jennifer Lopez, as I understand it, is going to be appearing alongside Vice President Harris at a rally in Nevada in the next few days. And so a question that lingers, in addition to the impact on the independence movement, is what impact will this outrage have on the U.S. presidential election?
Thank you, Dr. Horn, for that answer. And you know, on a sort of related topic of colonialism, land theft, displacement, global gentrification, and hypocrisy, we wanted to ask you about Bonaire and Barbuda. What should our audience know about these two Caribbean territories and, of course, other Caribbean territories and nations that are facing a new wave of colonial terror that is getting little to no attention, even from our friends on the left?
Well, as you know, this past Sunday, we had an online solidarity rally with Haiti. And in the context of that online rally, which was sponsored by comrades in Trinidad and Tobago, we had speakers from both Bonaire, a colonial appendage, if you like, of the Netherlands, and also Barbuda, the Caribbean island. And it occurred to me, as the comrade from Bonaire was speaking and talking about how the Netherlands was shipping in more Dutch nationals to occupy land, that this was a kind of gentrification, not unlike the gentrification that's afflicting Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, or Leimert Park, Los Angeles. It is ironic indeed that the European colonial powers kidnapped Africans centuries ago and then dropped them in Caribbean islands. And now apparently they've decided that that situation now has to change. And it also reminds me that with regard to Barbuda, they called out the Hollywood star, Robert De Niro, who apparently is involved in a land grab in Barbuda, as the comrade said, trying to take advantage of the sun, sea, and sand of this small Caribbean island. And it struck me, as it struck one of the speakers, that the role Robert De Niro is playing in Barbuda echoes the fictional role that he played in Killers of the Flower Moon, where he plays a villain who is taking advantage of Native Americans and Oklahoma, seizing their wealth some decades ago. And now in real life, he's trying to replicate that nefarious role in the Caribbean. In any event, I would point you to the Activist News Network for a video replay of that online rally about Haiti, and would also encourage you to follow the Activist News Network, because my understanding is that you'll be following up with interviews with the comrades from the Caribbean.
Yes, Dr. Warren, thank you. For those in the audience that haven't seen the Zoom that occurred this past Sunday, it is now on the Activist News Network, and we do hope to interview several of the comrades that gave solidarity messages and outlined what Dr. Horn just mentioned just now. But Dr. Horn, as we go around the horn, as the BRICS summit concluded last week, I know you wanted to reiterate the importance of the China, India, and time. Dr. Horn, how significant is this at times?
Oh, it's huge. That's why I want to return to it again. We'll probably return to it again and again in coming weeks. It is profoundly significant. First of all, as suggested last week, even though the nations of BRICS were not explicit about this for diplomatic and other reasons, it's apparent that they have de-dollarization in the crosshairs. And to the extent that de-dollarization is over the horizon, this is going to have enormous impact on the U.S. working class and those who are particularly dependent on fixed incomes, like Social Security recipients, and those who are afflicted with the stagnant wages. Not to put too fine a point on it, but there is a distinct possibility that within a few years, within the lifetime of many of us, we may be staring at the possibility of a gallon of milk costing $10 per gallon as a result of the loss of purchasing power of the dollar, and a cup of coffee perhaps costing $10. Now, I don't want to be alarmist and be a scaremonger, but at the same time, if we do not prepare for what's over the horizon, we're going to be victimized. But in any case, there are some elections as well that shows that the various constituencies across the globe are already trying to adjust to this coming reality. I'm referring to the election in Moldova, the neighbor of Ukraine, a former Soviet republic, which barely, and I mean barely, voted to pursue a relationship with the European Union. And that they did this in the face of enormous propaganda. Likewise, in Georgia, you had an opposite result, speaking of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, which is seeking to remain close to Moscow, despite enormous propaganda to the contrary. And then you see that with regard to BRICS, it's accepting more associate members. It's particularly strong in Africa, with South Africa, Egypt, and Ethiopia now joined by Algeria and Nigeria, for example. So this presents a very stiff and stern challenge to the Black Liberation Movement, the U.S. left. In a forthcoming article, I, in a sense, revise the notion of W.E.B. Du Bois, the late Pan-Africanist and intellectual, who spoke about double consciousness amongst Black Americans, two warring ideals in one body, that is to say, being a U.S. national and being of African descent, and there was a kind of conflict between the two. My notion is double allegiances. I'm not sure if Black Americans, or the U.S. left for that matter, can maintain an allegiance to Washington at the same time that the global South, led by South Africa, Egypt, Ethiopia, now Nigeria and Algeria, are moving in opposing direction. There's going to have to be a choice. And once again, there's no time like the present to begin to make that choice, Because once again, as U.S. imperialism loses altitude, there's no guarantee that this will benefit our constituency. Once again, the exploiting class, the investor class, might seize the opportunity to take even more out of our hide as they're on the retreat globally and internationally.
Thank you, Dr. Horn. And on a similar note, we wanted to ask you about an article from the Financial Times written by the well-known Egyptian-American economist and businessman Mohammed Abdul El Erian, entitled, quote, "Why the West Should Be Paying More Attention to the Gold Price Rise, Buying of the Precious Metal Reflects Rising Interest in Alternatives to the Dollar-Based Financial System," end quote. Dr. Horn, why should the West be paying more attention to the rise of the price and interest in gold?
Well, it speaks to what I've been speaking about in the last few minutes, the prospect of de-dollarization, the prospect of the world moving away from the dollar system. Obviously, it's a direct result of the fact that the U.S. imperialism has tried to confiscate billions of dollars and Russian assets to subsidize the ill-fated escapade in Ukraine. This has led to Russia being in the vanguard of seeking an alternative to the dollar-based system. And as the so-called fiat currency, recall what happened with so-called quantitative easing in approximately 2008, the United States turned on the printing press and started printing more pieces of green paper, and then using that to buy precious commodities, buy French wines and electronic goods and automobiles and all the rest. Well, it may not be far distant for this small planet to move to a system whereby instead of dollars being in the driver's seat, commodities like gold will be in the driver's seat. And of course, Russia is a major producer of gold. South Africa is a major producer of gold. Gold has risen 40% in value in the past year, which is an indication of this trend that I'm sketching. We can see other commodities as well, backing currencies from the BRICS nations, such as Russia. I'm thinking of natural gas from Russia, natural gas from Algeria. I'm thinking of oil from Nigeria, oil from Russia. And once again, let me reiterate that those of us who rely upon dollars, which is most of us, if not all of us in the United States of America, will be, to put it euphemistically, challenged severely if de-dollarization takes flight, if the rise of gold continues. And I recommend to the audience this article by Mohammed Arian, who, of course, is a leading financial capitalist, formerly managed the investments of the multi-billion dollar corporation known as Harvard University, a major bond trader as well. He is onto something, I do believe.
Yes, and a member of our audience also noted that he won the 2024 Nobel Peace Prize in economics. I don't know if that's accurate, but.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, but he's certainly highly regarded in elite circles, let's put it that way.
Well, Dr. Horn, as we go around the horn, we also wanted to ask you about the parliamentary election that occurred this past Sunday in Japan. Many analysts have said that the Sunday's election has left Japan in a political mess. As the Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP, which has ruled Japan for the past 70 years, lost its majority in the House of Representatives, which selects the prime minister. Leading the opposition party, the Constitutional Democratic Parties, the CDP, picked up a lot of seats, but far from a majority. So the conservatives and the LDP and the liberals and the CDP will spend the next few days or maybe even weeks trying to cobble together a governing coalition. But Dr. Horn, considering the recent and looming financial crisis in Japan and what now appears to be a potential political crisis, what is your reaction to Sunday's election in Japan?
Well, first of all, a self-criticism. Some decades ago, when I was noticing the hysteria about Japan, the Japanic, for example, when there was this idea that Japan was in the passing lane. We're talking about the early 1990s when the nostrum was the Cold War is over and Japan won. When Hollywood jumped on that bandwagon producing these Japanic movies like Iron Maze and Black Rain with Michael Douglas, Mr. Baseball. There's a whole slew of them. And particularly the novels of the late Michael Crichton, for example, especially the one starring Wesley Snipes and Sean Connery. I should have stressed more when I was making commentaries the fact that what helped to bring Japan to heel was once again this U.S. alliance with China, which put enormous pressure on Japan, helped to send its economy into a tailspin that arguably it has yet to recover from. And now, interestingly enough, Japan is in another tailspin, as reflected in these electoral results that you've just spoken to, because with the China-India entente, with Japan planning to rely heavily upon India in order to encircle China, that's blown up in their faces. They're going to have to seek possibly an entente with China, which is going to have enormous and profound impact on the global correlation of forces, not unlike the China-India entente. And it's going to present a challenge to the Japan left, which is more significant than the U.S. left. I mean, for example, the Japanese Communist Party is represented in the parliament, albeit not with that many seats. But I recall during the time, once again, of the early 1990s, when the JCP's Sunday newspaper sold 3 million copies. Now it's down to 800,000, but that was quite remarkable, more than the Sunday New York Times, even though the U.S. population is about three times the size of Japan's population of 110 million. So we would be remiss if we ignored the impact of this election in Japan, one of the top five economies on planet Earth, and also pointed to by U.S. imperialism as a kind of attack dog as they seek to encircle China.
Thank you, Dr. Horn, for that. And do you think we have time for another question or not?
Well, just 2 points. One is that the President Macron of France is spending 3 days this week in Morocco, quite an extraordinary length of time. Morocco is going to be sicked on Algeria. The payoff to Morocco is recognition of their illicit claim to the Western Sahara, oftentimes referred to as the final colony in Africa. But we're also going to have to pay attention to Morocco perhaps being sicked on Mali, for example, and the Association of Sahel States, including Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. And speaking of Burkina Faso, our friends in Ghana should pay attention to the religious zealotry that's afflicting the Burkina Faso-Ghana border. I dare say that the government of Accra has not been energetic in attacking that, perhaps because U.S. imperialism and French imperialism refer them to act otherwise. And the final point is this $3 billion fine imposed by Washington on TD Bank of Canada, which is a major bank in the United States of America. I think that irrespective of the crimes that TD Bank has been accused of, including money laundering, it reflects what I think is the very parlous circumstance in which Canada, the northern neighbor of the United States, finds itself in light of the fact that it has bad relations with Russia, China, and India. The fact that Prime Minister Trudeau, the liberal, is not necessarily warmly embraced by Mr. Trump, who might be in the White House in a few weeks. The only good news I can say with regard to Canada is that British Columbia, the socialists are in power. The Social Democrats are in power, the New Democratic Party. And let's end on that bit of good news.
Thank you so much, Dr. Horn. And you truly covered a lot of ground today. We thank you so much for that. We do want to note for the audience to keep an eye on what's going on in Bolivia with the assassination attempt of Evo and potential infighting between President Arce and Evo in the MAS party, which at the end of the day can only strengthen U.S. and Wall Street imperialism. And also for our internationalists and friends on the left, please keep an eye on the uprising taking place in Martinique and Guadeloupe, and provide solidarity to them. Again, thank you, Dr. Horn, and thank you to the audience for tuning in. And we look forward to speaking with you again next week, Dr. Horn.
We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people. Power to the people, free political prisoners.